This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a stunning title card in a documentary short at Sundance this year. Broadly, the film is about the cases of serial sexual abuse by Boy Scout leaders throughout the country. And the film points out that so far, experts have identified more than 12,000 victims of sexual misconduct associated with the Boy Scouts and nearly 8,000 perpetrators. But here's an even more stunning part of all of that. That number, which is probably low, by the way, is a higher concentration of abuse than has been found in the Catholic Church. The film is built around one story in particular, the story of Adam Steed, who was abused in an Idaho scout camp when he was 14 years old. Adam spoke out about the abuse when authorities tried to cover it up and keep him quiet. He talked to the local newspaper. And the film is about the cover-up, but one of the things that complicates this story is the role of clergy. In this case, the role of Mormon clergy. Boy Scout groups are often connected to religious organizations. It's also about the freedom of the press in many ways. The film is called Church and the Fourth Estate, and I should mention there are some sensitive and adult themes in this show, and it may not be for everyone. Joining us on the program is Brian Knappenberger. He's the director of the film. It's an official selection in the documentary shorts program, and he's joining us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. And Brian Knappenberger, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
I mentioned Adam Steed, subject of the film. He's also joining us here in the studio. And Adam Steed, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me on.
Brian, I want to begin with you and how you started thinking about this story. Now, as I understand it, you didn't set out to tell the story of scouting and child sexual abuse. You were, in fact, looking at something kind of quite different, billionaires who were attacking the press. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. Yeah, that is how I started this. I think I started, you know, I was interested in this series of stories that were published in southern Idaho in the Idaho Falls Post-Register by writers, by Peter Zuckerman and his editor, Dean Miller. And, you know, what they had uncovered was a bizarre situation in which there was this case file that was erased from the court system there. And when they dug deeper, they uncovered this systemic abuse at a Boy Scout camp there in southern Idaho called Camp Little Lemhi. And I was just really interested in the backlash that they experienced in the community. Some people thought these stories were really important. They were very much in the public good. Others believed the paper was kind of airing the town's dirty laundry, and they pushed back. And so I was actually looking at that, crafting a story about local press. I'm interested and concerned about local press. I think it's losing a lot of its financial underpinnings, that sort of, and so I had started making a paper about a short about that.
Yeah.
And then I just met one of the, you know, courageous boys who stepped forward, Adam Steed, and after he agreed to interview with me for the first time, his just candor and honesty about these difficult experiences, and just the courage that he had in talking about them. I was just moved by that, and I understood right away that he would be the center point of the film.
Hmm.
And I think what they didn't know when they wrote these stories, what Peter or Dean Miller or even Adam at the time couldn't have known, is how big this problem was.
Yeah.
And since then, we now understand the extent of the problem within the Boy Scouts organization.
It's interesting. You actually had made a short, but then you kind of scrapped it and decided to start over again. And I guess this was when you decided that, as you mentioned, you would build the story around Adam and his story.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good film, but I thought it could be better, and I thought there was more there. So we basically just kind of went back to the drawing board and said, you know, what is the heart of this story? And when we found Adam and when he agreed to talk to me, just the raw courage and the blunt honesty of his interview, I realized that this was the heart of the story. That in telling his story, we were able to get at these issues that were really, really critical. And it's sort of what happened when he came forward. I mean, I think a lot of people argued about whether this was an isolated event at the time. But what they uncovered really was an enormous, enormous problem that's been going on for decades, probably back to the very beginning of the Boy Scouts in 1910.
Yeah. We'll talk more about this as we go along, but I want to ask how you are thinking about what this film is about, because there's the element of clergy, like broadly speaking, because this as – and it's important to point out, this kind of abuse, as we'll talk about, is happening – has happened in every state of the country. It happens in all walks of life, as someone mentions in the film. So it happens everywhere. But there's also a particular twist related to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so how are you thinking about what part of this is just sort of broadly about scouting and broadly about clergy and the particulars of the sort of distinctive elements of Mormonism in this particular faith?
Yes. I mean, the Boy Scouts and the Mormon Church are deeply connected historically. You know, for many years, the Boy Scouts was the official men's program of the Mormon Church. And, you know, it's estimated at times, I've heard various estimates, that 30 to 40% of all Boy Scout troops are Mormon related. So it's these organizations are very, very closely connected and have been since the 20s. And I think one of the problems that we look at in the film when it comes to clergy and bishops in particular is that when instances of abuse were uncovered within that community, you know, if a scout leader was part of the Mormon community, the scout leader would then be sent to a bishop.
Yeah.
And then if the bishop deemed them, cured or that they had repented, they would be sent back into the Boy Scouts. And the Mormon faith, repentance is absolute. And so you are sent back into whatever position you were in before the report, and very often they would not go to authorities, and they wouldn't tell the victim's family. So then, of course, this is puts that person back into a position where they can harm more children, and they do. They ended up abusing again and again. So we know that now, and so. Is one thing about this that probably should be mentioned is that in Utah there's a bill named HB 90 that is pushing to rescind this kind of privilege that the clergy has, that they're making it a requirement that clergy has to go to the authorities when they hear a crime, like it is in other instances of therapists and other in secular walks of life.
But how much of this did you – I mean, as you were thinking about what the film would be about, what to focus on, I mean, it's interesting that – it's about scouting, but it's all. But the title is church.
Yeah.
So how much of this is about church, about the clergy part, about the Mormon part, which is, as I said, we'll get to sort of the distinctive elements of how Mormonism plays into all of this when we get to Adam's story. But just how are you thinking about that? And as you talk about the film, you know, this week, as you're talking to people about it, what part of it is about something more broad, and what part of it is about church, what part of it is about the scouting, or can you really tease those two apart in some ways?
I don't think in this story you can really tease them apart, although the you know, both of these institutions I think failed and have a system that's failing kids. You know, one of the most staggering things about this is these you know, in the last year we've really understood the depth of the problem with the Boy Scouts in when there's been a series of lawsuits that have revealed these perversion files. What they're called is the ineligible volunteer files. Actually, inside the Boy Scouts they're called the perversion files. And this is a you know, this is a situation, a kind of mechanism they had where perpetrators would be named and listed, and the idea was not to let them back into the scouts. But it didn't work very well. There were lots of instances where people were being kicked out of the scouting organization but then were let right back in when they made a small alteration to their name, changed one letter in their name, or went down the road to another scout group. And there were lots of instances, staggering. It's a staggering number of instances that where the scouts looked the other way, did the same kind of thing where they didn't go to the authorities right away. They tried to keep it quiet. I think the combination of these two things, the Mormon approach to this and the Boy Scouts more than willing to look away, create two giant institutions that are very, very important in some of these communities and have held themselves up as moral leaders. Have this kind of secrecy and this closeness of these organizations has really created a toxic environment.
Adam Steed, I wanted to ask you, and thanks for joining us, by the way, again. I I know this isn't easy to talk about, and that's quite clear, I have to say, in the documentary. As you mentioned, you're shaking when you talk about it. It's clearly a profound experience. But I wanted to ask you, as what we see in the beginning of the film is you talk about your sense of faith and you talk about your sense of trust. So talk to me a little bit about that you were told, as you say in the film, to follow your leaders no matter what. Could you just talk about that part of this story?
Yeah, so I was actually born in Wymount Terrace, the married housing at BYU, and I always joke around how I was born in the bedroom. People say, hey, you know, the rabbit hatch, they call that place. I was born in the rabbit hatch, right. Traded for macrame. My dad worked at the MTC. He was a gospel doctrine teacher at the MTC. My great uncle was the temple president in Johannesburg. We came from pioneer stock. We had blessings from Joseph Smith about, you know, the descendants in our family that we would help the church in great ways.
And so fully in for a long time, the Mormon church.
Yeah. You can ask me right now what the 13th article of faith is. I memorized them. I read the Book of Mormon literally 18 times before my mission.
Wow.
You know, to me, this was God's kingdom on earth, and we can help people in so many ways, and to see the good in people and the good in things it's my entire life.
Yeah. You were to the point that you mentioned of asking questions could jeopardize your standing in the church. Talk a little bit about just when you have this experience and you have an opportunity to say something about it, to tell something about it, how does that come in conflict with that deep sense of protecting your church or protecting leaders? What's the conflict there, if you can talk about that?
So we're just taught, we're told stories in church over and over of people who've apostatized and how it started when they trusted like themselves instead of the ordained brethren that God gave us to tell us what to do. And, you know, these are horrible stories. Usually once someone apostatized, all these other horrible, bad things happen to them. And, you know, and so that's kind of really ingrained inside of us that, you know, if God's talking directly with these people, we should listen to these leaders and stronger than our own judgment. But at the same time, the church teaches that, you know, the Holy Ghost will guide us and we'll be convicted and we'll have our own conviction. So it's not like we just have to listen.
Yeah.
The Holy Ghost will let us know. And I prayed about it and I got this strong answer that the Book of Mormon was true. And so the whole church must be true. And, you know, you hold that spiritual conviction when you're a kid to all these other things. You know, the prophets must be true. The church must be true. The stake presidents must be true because they called them. And the bishops must be true because they called them. And you just follow these people and you're going to be okay.
When you were abused in the time after that, did you find yourself praying to God about what to do? Or, I mean, like, how did prayer fit into that part?
Yeah, so I prayed through the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know if, like, I had a lot of cognitive dissonance, I guess that's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this guy that abused me was becoming a seminary teacher. And all the good in his character and the way that it was presented weighed so heavily upon me that the wires in my head didn't even connect to the abuse for an extended period of time. Like, I understand what it's like to be smart, to be intelligent, and not be able to put two and two together for a while.
Yeah. Brian, let me bring you into this part of the conversation, because this idea of Adam Stead's moral compass, Dean Miller mentions this in the Post Register. He mentions this in the documentary that Adam has this moral compass, and it's so ironic that there's the moral compass part of him that wants to protect his church, but then there's the other part of him that has to tell the truth, that has to say something about that.
Yeah.
That's an important part of this story, it seems.
Yes, I do. I think so. I mean, I think what Dean Miller says is an extraordinary moral compass. I couldn't agree more. I think that was clear to me from the very first interview that I did with him, and just understanding the events of what he went through. But it's become even more clear, actually, after that interview, as we were putting the film together, as we looked around at other cases. I mean, it is extraordinarily unusual for someone to step forward. There are lots of people suffering in silence here and just trying to put this behind them. And I think that's, you know, that's hurt a lot of people. It's hurt their lives, just that kind of suffering in silence. So, you know, he's unique in a lot of ways in his courage of in coming forward. I think hopefully this film and people seeing the fact that he came forward could add to that. I mean, I love the phrase courage is contagious. So, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of hope that's part of what the film is able to do.
Brian, can you mention the decision that you made to take Adam back to that camp, which is a really kind of powerful moment? You take Adam back. Just talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think I was talking to Adam about where it happened and what it meant to him. And I think in the course of that conversation, I don't know if I brought it up or if he brought it up, but we started talking about it. And you know, I was worried about what it might bring up. He'd never been back to that camp. And you know, again, speaking to the courage, he sort of felt like, he said, let's do this. I want to confront these memories. I want to change these memories. I want to make them into something different. And I just thought that was amazing. And there was something
thank you, Brian.
A place. Yeah. There was something about a place that does hold these things. But I guess the point is that we can change those things and within us.
One of the things you say, Adam, in the film is you don't want to be scared by that place. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. My dad one time was writing a book for me. I think he knew of the trauma I was going through, and he wrote a little book for me about this guy named Jose Landscaper. And what he did was he would go down this street and he would remodel people's yards. And my dad, the analogy was that the houses were different memories. And he showed that there were like treads in the grass where there were these worn trails going to some of the scariest houses. And this Jose guy, this little Mexican guy with the truck, it would go down the road and he would fix these houses and remodel the landscaping so they'd be beautiful and so that people could, in their memories, they could just like remodel their memories. They couldn't get rid of them, but they could remodel them and make them beautiful. And so I think for a long time I've wanted to take some of my scariest memories and try to put something else there. And I think when Brian talked to me about this, even though I knew it would be super scary, I think the thought of other children not having to go through this, or other adults being able to get help with this through my story, was something that I thought was more beautiful than the memories that I had.
Adam Steed is with us. He's one of the subjects of the documentary short Church and the Fourth Estate. It's an official selection in the Sundance Film Festival documentary shorts program this year. We're also talking with the director, Brian Knappenberger. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you want public radio listeners to learn more about your business or organization, consider becoming a KUER sponsor. You can support informative, engaging programming through a variety of opportunities on our radio, digital, and events platforms. We're proud to partner with the community to bring trustworthy journalism to Utah. To learn more about becoming a sponsor, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on business support.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a documentary short at Sundance this year. It's called Church and the Fourth Estate. When Adam Steed was young, he reported to authorities that his scout leader was sexually abusing him. And they told him not to tell his parents, that it would be taken care of. But Adam did tell his parents. He told others, even as some local leaders in a small conservative Idaho community did what they could to keep the story from spreading. Adam's story is just one among thousands of similar tales in the scouting world, where sexual abuse allegations have grown in alarming numbers in recent years. We're talking about the documentary short, Church and the Fourth Estate, today. Adam Steed is joining us here in the studio. We also have the director, Brian Knappenberger, who's joining us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. Brian, I wanted to talk about the sort of, I guess, the press part, the the journalism part of the story, because it's an important part of it. Let's talk about Peter Zuckerman, his role, because it's really interesting. He is, on one hand, what you have is, you know, a reporter covering a story. But then there's this also really deeply personal element to this story. I guess you must not have realized when you started this that that would be a part of it, that there would be also a personal twist to the reporting of the story?
Yeah, that part was pretty fascinating. When the stories came out, as I mentioned, there was a big backlash within the Idaho Falls community. Again, some people really thought that they, you know, these stories were in the public good and were important. And others pushed back on the stories. And one of the people that pushed back on the stories was the richest man in Idaho, a man named Frank Vandersloot. And what he did was he took out full-page ads in the same paper in which the stories appeared in the Idaho Falls Post-Register. He called them community page ads. And he used these series of ads that he had bought in the paper to really question the veracity of the stories. I think if you read
Brian,
the ads,
can I stop you for one quick sec? Because I want to actually play a moment from the film, if it's okay. Because this is something that – this is kind of remarkable. So the sensitivities in the film are front and center. Obviously, the personal sensitivities, but the legal ones are there too. And I want to play this moment where Dean Miller, we were talking about, he's this intrepid, well-respected editor at the newspaper, and he has to be really incredibly careful in your conversation with him, even doesn't want to mention the name of this important player in the story. Here is this moment from the documentary, because I think it gives some illustration for what we're talking about.
In the sort of upper power echelons of the community, it was like, who is this newspaper to be airing our dirty laundry? You know, it's none of their business. So there was a lot of anger about that and certain amount of embarrassment and certainly there's that's as far as I should go. Can I just say, I'm reluctant to talk about one of the critics in particular because $1 billion is an extraordinary amount of money.
Okay, I think that was an important thing to play because we need to get the legal sensitivities and details out of the way. There's this lawsuit that's coming into play, and it's really keeping Peter Zuckerberg, it's keeping Dean Miller from being able to tell the full elements of the story. Is that fair and accurate to say?
That's right. They're both somewhat restricted in what they could say, especially Peter Zuckerman. So these community page ads were just we were sort of pushback on this, and we follow in the film sort of what happens after that, the next series of events is that Mother Jones magazine is creating is doing some campaign reporting on campaign finance and Frank Vandersloot's name and the company that he founded, Melaleuca. Their name comes up as donors to the Romney campaign, to the Mitt Romney campaign, and they look into it and write a story about this, about Frank Vandersloot. They look into these series of donations. And they mention the Scouts Honor series. Scouts Honor is the series that Peter Zuckerman and Dean Miller created. And in doing that, they again spark there's another dust up in which Frank Vandersloot then goes after Mother Jones magazine for a couple of things that they say that involve defamation. But one at the heart of the suit, which is unusual, one of the lawyers one of the very prominent media lawyers that represented Mother Jones magazine said is one of the most unusual cases he's ever seen. It really came down to the issue of Peter Zuckerman's sexuality. Yeah. In the community page ads that Frank Zuckerman posted in the Idaho Falls Post Register, he mentions that Peter Zuckerman
Frank Vandersloot. Sorry, you said Zuckerman, yeah. But yeah. Just make
oh, I'm
clear.
Sorry. I'm sorry. In the community page ads Frank Vandersloot puts in the Idaho Falls Post Register, he mentions that Peter Zuckerman is gay. And he mentions this in the context that it may in some way have some bias over the reporting. And then it begins a debate that whether or not that this is the he has actually outed Peter Zuckerman in the Idaho Falls. Now, he says that that Peter Zuckerman's sexuality was already known in Idaho Falls, had been discussed on a local radio station and other things. So he did not out Peter Zuckerman. Peter Zuckerman has at various times, at various points, said, look, there was a big backlash against me after that was well known. And particularly after the paper that published this, that and that caused me pretty much to be unable to do my job. Eventually, he said that he was targeted before those ads were out as well. After this lawsuit dust up,
this was a condition of the lawsuit, and this is why everyone has to be so careful. Is because technically, as Vandersloot's attorneys made him say, Zuckerman had to say it was technically true that he hadn't been outed by Vandersloot in those ads, and that it had been discussed in another venue, as you say, on the radio, and that he had been sort of publicly attacked before the ads came out. So all of that is sort of this
part of
disclaimer that has to be part of it. And it's just important to understand that if you watch the film, which makes it clear. But I have to say, as a filmmaker, it must have been difficult to sort of have to dance around all of that. And you must have been a little worried yourself about Vandersloot and his litigiousness or potential litigiousness.
Well, it has occurred to us for sure. But I think, you know, look, what we're trying to do is tell the series of events here in an honest and truthful way as we can. And because I think that this is important. I think that this is that we're in an era in which the press is experiencing all sorts of attacks from all sorts of different directions, including from very wealthy people. And, you know, these sorts of lawsuits can be very dangerous for journalism.
Yeah. I want to ask you about – there's this really powerful moment where Peter Zuckerman is being deposed during this defamation trial. And I won't play the moment because I don't want to reveal too much. It's a sort of profound part of the film. But he talks about this experience of having reported this story. Adam Steed and his father comes to him. He reports this story. This is a small conservative community. There's a massive backlash, as you say. The richest man in town, a billionaire, goes after them, the paper for all of this. And Zuckerman is – just talk a little bit about his reaction, if you would, because he talks about it being one of the darkest periods of his life.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very moving part. When we found that part of the deposition, it really kind of hit me what he went through. This lawsuit was so much about whether or not he had been outed, and whether or not, it also had to do with the way that Mother Jones had written about it in a tweet by the Mother Jones CEO Monica Bauerlin. But what the lawsuit came down to had a lot to do with whether or not Peter Zuckerman had been outed, and what the reaction was in the community to his being outed and to him being gay, and whether that happened before or after these community page ads. In other words, did the community page ads cause him to have extra duress? And you know, he's deposed for something like 10 hours. It's very, very, very stressful. The questions keep coming. If you watch them, they keep coming. They're continually about these issues. They're trying to go at it over and over again, and to try to parse this language about when all this went down. But what's absolutely completely clear from the deposition is the toll it took on Peter Zuckerman. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, there is a point when he's asked, I don't know how many times he's been asked, but at some point it just overtakes him and he breaks down in this deposition and just has to take a break. He just can't go on anymore because he's recalling these instances that happened to him and talking about what he says is the darkest period of his life.
Adam Steed, I wonder if I can get you to talk a little bit about the reaction you have the courage to go and talk to the local paper. This series of stories comes out. and you talk about this in the film, the reaction that you got, it was a fairly – we got a lot of bullying. Do you mind talking about the way the community reacted, the way you were targeted as a result of coming forward?
Yeah. So it was a really homophobic community. And, you know, I wasn't really aware of what all that means now. You know, I was just raised in this community. And then as a victim of child abuse, I was treated the same way that the community treated homosexual people. And it opened my eyes to the persecution, to the sensitivities, and to the ignorance that homosexuals have felt by my community and my church. While I was so active in church, I was being persecuted the same way that homosexual people were persecuted by my church. And so when I watched Peter in this film, this deposition, the part where he started crying because he couldn't talk about it, that's like, you know, the same thing that I felt. So
yeah,
that community.
You talk about being shunned by the community, and I wonder, was it – because it was so interesting. Was it for being molested? Is that what they were shunning you about? Or was it because you had the audacity to say something? Or was it a bit of both of that? Could you tell?
You know, the thing was, I remember these kind of discussions in church where people had justified why we were so against homosexual marriages and things like that. And it just seems like that community, in trying to justify what their leaders had done, had come up with so many sensical reasons on their own, even though they weren't the people that would know. And the lines of homosexuality and child abuse and perpetrators were blurred together with all these weird causalities and fears that the community had created so strong to support their point of views, that then when I became a victim of sexual child abuse, kids were calling me a fag. They were telling me that I did it and that I enjoyed it and that I loved it. They were acting like I was an unsafe person to be around. It was horrifying, and it was eye-opening to be friends with Peter later and realize that here is this man that is trying to help the truth come out. And he's got his career, you know, his career is being destroyed. His life's being destroyed after he just told my story. He literally wrote exactly what I told him when he asked the question. In other words, he just didn't edit it. He just
wrote what you said.
He just wrote my story. And so I watched all this people attack him, you know, and it makes me wonder that why would Frank's article of showing that that Peter was homosexual, why would that undercut him telling my story in this Mormon community?
Yeah. Do you ever go back to that Mormon community? I'm sure you do. It must have family there still, or?
Yeah, actually, I made a Facebook post about just one of the articles of one of these interviews from this. And between yesterday and today, I have had maybe another 10 people open up about being sexually abused in that area. It's funny, some of the bullies that beat me up in junior high
wow,
are supportive of what I'm doing right now, writing me on Facebook. And some of the kids in those circles were victims, and I'm hearing it, you know, when you get, I'm just, my phone's been going for 2 days from different victims telling who was raped by who when they were 13 and, you know, same pedophiles in same area. And some of these kids were the ones that persecuted me for what was going on.
Brian, what's the reaction you're getting?
It's been an emotional week, to say the least. The Adam keeps sending me these reactions, and it's just been staggering. I think we got we had the same reaction when we screened the film live. People were really emotional, crying, and lengthy standing ovation. It's been pretty phenomenal. It also gave me the opportunity to talk to the Mormon community directly on various radio stations and others, and my overall impression is that the community, that community is ready for this discussion, and that they, a lot of people there feel like it's time to really confront this head on.
I should mention there's going to be a screening of the film at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. It's going to be tomorrow evening at 9 o'clock. We'll give you details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Brian, let's talk a little bit more about the relationship between the LDS Church and the scouting program. I want to play another moment from the film. This is one of the attorneys you spoke with. He's an attorney named Tim Kosnoff, who represents sex abuse survivors. And he has this this contention and this idea about the role of the Mormon community and the role of, I guess, Mormonism in this particular story. Let's play this moment from the film.
Especially in the Mormon community, you see a backlash against individuals who come forward and disclose. Mormons are taught that the doctrine of repentance and forgiveness is absolute, and that if an individual has repented of his sin to a bishop, and the bishop is satisfied that it's sincere, then under church teachings, that individual must be forgiven. And church lawyers have argued this in my cases, that cleansed the individual of his sins, and he was a new person, and he must be restored to the position he was in.
What is he getting at there? He also says in that particular moment that they're taught that they're in the world but not of the world. And you have to keep this within what he says is the Mormon family. What is his contention there?
Yeah, I mean, I think Adam could probably speak to this pretty in a personal way. But the idea, I think, is that some of these problems are best handled within the church, that to go to a bishop with these problems is the right thing to do, and that the bishop can make the decision about whether the person has repented, whether this will happen again, that sort of thing, and that there's no need to go to the authorities with this. You know, of course this is dangerous. If this is a crime, the authorities should be alerted immediately. And I think that's one of the most important things about this new Utah law, HB 90, is that it would rescind that kind of privilege from clergy. You know, I think there is a broader sense that within the church that these things can be handled without bringing them into public view. And I guess as a journalist and as a filmmaker, I couldn't disagree with that premise more. You know, I think both of these organizations, the Boy Scouts and the Mormon Church, have created a kind of secrecy here that is toxic. And these are both organizations that have held themselves up as moral leaders. But when they really were confronted with an important choice, a moral and ethical choice, they failed. And I think it's time to sort of confront that.
Adam, how are you thinking about all of that?
You know, I think it's different when a pedophile comes in on his own to talk to a bishop than when he gets caught at scout camp and the directors call the bishop and send him in. Because, like, I mean, I get that the church thing is a way that sinners can come in and talk when they're not ready and get prepared to do the right decisions for correct action. But when there's a systematic use of sending caught people to the church to rebound them back into the system without anyone knowing about it, instead of, you know, it seems like what we actually have is a capitalistic system hiding behind a religious front.
You've talked about the fact that there was in the trial of the man who abused you, that there were a number of sort of prominent Latter-day Saint leaders who played roles in all of that, and not in denouncing this man, but in maybe defending him
Yeah, so, you know, like when, you know, there's a lot of power that your bishop and your stake president have over you, especially when you're 13 or 14 years old and you've confessed to looking at Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition.
Right.
And you think that you might never, you might go to hell. And, you know, these guys know your most embarrassing thing in your life. And, you know, and you've had these brother man-to-man conversations and set you on the right path with God and stuff. And the stake president of Brad Stolz, who I knew, who I knew quite well, got up in court and testified in Brad's favor, saying that what I said must not be correct, that he knew Brad, and Brad was such a good person. And when I heard him speak, I remember sitting there in that courtroom watching him testify to get Brad out of the criminal charges. And I remember thinking that he was telling the truth and I was crazy in my head. And, you know, and I just sat there and I felt like he was telling the truth. And he got done speaking and I was like, well, there's the truth. And then I just sat there and this little voice like coming up, but that's not the truth. You know, and it's not what really happened. It's not what happened to me. It's not what happened to all those other boys. It's not, you know, it's just like, but that man's called from God and he has the power of God to do God's will. You know, and it just, but it's not what really happened.
I should mention, Brian, that we reached out to the LDS Church and they gave us a statement. Let me read it. They write, "We have not seen this film and only recently learned it was in production." I'll ask you about that in a minute. "Regardless, our hearts ache for all survivors of abuse. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has zero tolerance for abusive behavior of any kind, and we are committed to addressing these incidents wherever they are found. Protecting victims and ensuring proper reporting is our top priority." So there's their reaction. To the point that they only recently learned of this production, say something about that, because you said you reached out and they didn't want to talk to you.
They declined to talk to us, yeah. We asked them for a statement. We asked them for an interview, and they declined. Same is true with the Boy Scouts, and same is true with Frank Vandersloot. Although we did have an exchange with Frank Vandersloot in which he said, I actually thought he might be in the film for a little bit. I really wanted him to be in the film. His first email was direct response to us. Happened over a year ago, and he has publicly said that he didn't know about the film recently too. But our first email exchange was about a year ago. It was pretty, it was nice actually. And I actually held out hope that it would, that he would be in the film. I wanted him to be in the film. I would have given him a platform to state his position as accurately as possible. And, I wished he would have ended up being in the film. Yeah. He declined. The dispute there was that he wanted us to have a 3-hour off-the-record conversation with his lawyers first, and that wasn't something we were willing to do.
Yeah. Adam, yeah.
So I had a bishop one time tell me that he needed to take my temple recommend away. He didn't say it was because of any of my actions. He said it was this, I can't remember the actual word, but it was like to save goodwill face, to save face for how the church would look to other people. And
wow.
He said that he described it actually as that, like, if I was in the temple and other people were in the temple and they knew about these dark things that had happened, that it would make them think like that kind of stuff was involved in the temple and around the temple, and that until better time, that I needed to not have a temple recommend.
We should, to be fair to the church, this is like people have talked about getting a lottery system when you have a local lay leader who says just dopey things like that. But there are others who are sensitive, and maybe we should say something about that at this point, right? There are, because I have to say, one of the really powerful moments of the film was the fact that a bishop reached out to you, and you say this in the film, and was lovely and was really supportive and really sensitive.
Yeah, actually, I think that most of the bishops I've ever had were incredibly good people. And I can think of several of the things that they've done that really guided and helped my life. And so, you know, I think that it's not fair to the bishops to be implicated in this issue. I think that the real problem is just there was a systematic covering up of child abuse, and these bishops were in the same boat that I was, that I had to follow what my church leader said, and that, you know, they'd get on their line on their, and they would make their phone calls. And at some point, you know, the church would tell them what to do and how to do. And it was interesting in Idaho, like, there were so many church leaders that were not okay with what was going on, and they were reaching out to our family, and they were saying, we are absolutely against this, what they're doing. You need to go forward. In fact, it was a church leader in the area, a local church leader over the Idaho area, that told my father and me that we needed to sue scouting, that, you know, because the church is very much against suing, and he said, you need to bring this out. And that actually endorsed my decision to sue scouting as an older to bring this out so that it would stop the bad people and the problems that he was seeing as a church leader in the area.
Yeah. Brian, I wanted to ask you about this, this question that you put to Adam in the film. It's on camera, where you don't seem incredulous, but you are interested why it is that Adam stays within the Mormon church.
Yeah.
Would you just talk a little bit about that moment? Because, and Adam, of course, I want to hear you on this question, but that all of the bad things that had happened to him didn't seem to disqualify his faith or his participation in Mormonism, at least then.
Yeah, it's one of the last questions I asked him in our first interview. We did a couple of interviews. But, you know, after just hearing this staggering story that he was telling, and as not a member of a church and not a religious person myself, that's the question I had. Why, after all of this, why are you staying with the church? Why you still, you know, consider yourself part of the church, and you believe that, you know, you believe that these things can be changed by members of the church, can be changed from within, and that that's worth it, that the community meant a lot to him. And I found that a very moving statement. And I does go back to, I guess, what Adam just said, and my experience in the last week being at Sundance is that within the community there are people struggling with these issues and thinking about these issues in a critical way and wanting to have a discussion that's nuanced and that tries to make the church better. So it felt like including that was important. And Adam's decision not to turn his back on the church, I think if you watch the film, you might ask the same question. Why are you still with the church? And I thought his answer was very moving and nuanced, and that's why we essentially end the film with that.
Yeah. Adam, we're pretty much out of time, but I want to give you a chance to say something finally about that, if you would.
So, as you may assume, it's very difficult for me now to be in a church setting. But, you know, growing up, I liked how I felt when I loved the idea of an eternal marriage. And having, like, make a big deal out of love and have a beautiful family and protect it and all that kind of stuff. And I've loved a lot of the church values. It's just been such a hard thing for me to sort through how the same system that I put my trust and my love in for these values would undercut these values to save face. And I know that's not the whole church that does this. And my biggest reason to come forward and talk about this here and now is because our society needs to talk about this so that we can, those who choose can keep these values, but that we don't have like this double standard where we feel like we go crazy because we're creating these values. And at the same time, the people representing those values are allowing child abuse to happen and covering it up.
It's Adam Stead. He's one of the subjects in the documentary short, Church and the Fourth Estate. Thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for having us.
And Brian Knappenberger joined us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. Brian, thanks to you.
Thank you.
It's an official selection in the documentary shorts program, the documentary, and it's getting one more screening at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City tomorrow at 9 o'clock. We'll put details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcast. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.